would be not to start the B deduction. I just thought I didn't want to be in the middle of that. So we'll just continue with the subjective deduction and paralogisms. Think of paralogisms as a kind of holiday, kind of a way of having fun with puns. And we will start in with the deduction. So the subjective deduction, just to recapitulate slightly and introduce it from a slightly different angle, is an argument with four premises and a conclusion. Let's call it the unity premise, which states that all representations of which I am aware have the unity of apperception. The synthesis premise, which states that representations can have such unity only if synthesized. Category premise, which states that syntheses are possible or require categories. And then leading to our conclusion, categories apply to all representations of which I'm aware. Now, let me just say a word at least about the first two premises. So the thought is that consciousness or representational consciousness requires some version of unity. Unity requires synthesis. Synthesis requires categories. It's all very neat and simple. Unity, of course, is a property and a principle, and the unity of that perception requires, again, not simply awareness of each representation, but rather, quoting from B133, the thought is, only so far as I can conjoin one representation with another and am conscious of them. So the thought is that, and this is again opposed to Leibniz, opposed to Descartes, opposed to you, Locke, anybody you can think of, it's not that consciousness, we need to get representations related to consciousness. It's we need a connection of representations. We need a way of unifying them. So the example that everyone uses, that everyone loves, is from Henry James's Principles of Psychology, Volume 1, page 278. It's again one of those books, it's two volumes, but you can read it in bed at night before you go to sleep. It's really a beautiful read. I love reading James. And James says, you know, I'm going to give each person a word, and then, you know, for a sentence, and then I'm going to put them all together, and I want them to get really close to one another, and then I want each of them to think their word. Well, by that means, there is no thought, so that each word has consciousness attached to it is not enough to create a thought, right? A thought is about the connection of words, the connection of representations, how they are hooked up and conjoined with one another. So the thing about the I think, right, is it's the unity about perception is the unity of their togetherness for me. The I think doesn't merely accompany each representation, but rather expresses itself as their unity. So put it the way that I preferred, I wanted to say that it's an awareness of representations as representations. Hence, it follows that the unity of mind, at least as Kant is going to conceive of it, is neither a center nor a system. I mean, usually the typical either-or here is you either go Cartesian or Humean, right? It's got to be one or the other. If you're a Humean, you know, you're going to say that what generates the unity of consciousness is that representations bear certain relations to one another of memory and causality and the like, right? And therefore they create an internal system. But that's not good, because you need the system of the system. You need more than unity, continuity, causality. But neither is the mind, as it were, related to each one as an external prop. So it's more like the I think is the point of view that is expressed by the syntactical unity of the judgment. I mean by that that the unity that matters first, the unity of representations that matters first, is the unity they achieve as being components of a single judgment. Right? So my concepts are representations of objects, and what hooks those judgments, those concepts together, are the logical functions of judgment. S is P. That's the kind of unity that matters in the first instance. In the first instance. So it's going to get more complicated. But we need at least that. And consequently, the unity we require of the representative object, my awareness of the object, is an awareness of the object as square. So it has a complexity to it, and the complexity is not the complexity, at this instance, that is made up of four lines, although that's a kind of spatial complexity. The complexity that matters is his categorical complexity, and therefore is categorical unity, that is the unity of an object having properties. And I will say more about let me just give the hint that's going to take us much further. And the hint is this. In order for something to count as a representation for me, it must be connectable to the rest of my representation. It must be possible for me, right, to bring it in and connect it up. So, example. Think again. Here, what do I want as an analogy? Space will do. Remember our problem of two absolutely discrete spaces and its unintelligibility? We'll use that analogy for all representations. There can't be a representation that's like that tropical space where I said we could get to only by falling asleep and waking up, right? There can't be a representation that I cannot track and connect up with the rest of my representations. Otherwise, it's going to idle. If it's not temporally connected, not spatially connected, not causally connected, and ergo, not inferentially or deductively connected, then it ain't doing any work. Then it's cognitively idle. So in order for something not to idle, it must be connectable with my other representations. And that's to say that all representation, let's call it the whole goddamn world, you can think of as simply a big judgment. A big, fat, expanded judgment. That's the way the argument, the rest of the deduction is going to run when we get there. Now, what follows from this, so unity is about, ultimately, about connectability, and connectability is going to be always about the relationship between judgmental connectability, what a philosopher like Brandom would call inferential connectability, right? You have to be able to find some inferential relations between one set of concepts and others. And worldly connectability, that is, it has to be in some time, some place, and some causal relations with every other item. Connectability is the principle of cognitive significance. So the unity of apperception, that notion of unity that the I think enters, introduces, ultimately is going to be a print. So you can see how quickly, I mean, just to again leap ahead a little bit, you can see how quickly you can get from S is P to let's have a philosophical system of everything. The notion of system simply is a natural extension of the principle of connectability. And the principle of connectability is an immediate, right, demand for anything to enter into cognitive meaningfulness in the first place. Now, Kant wants to say, and now I just want to underline this, I want to underline it by having a little debate with Cleve, who seems to misunderstand Kant here, is the synthesis premise. Unity only of synthesis. And then Cleve very nicely uses in order to analogize the problem of synthesis the idea of a flea on the back of an elephant. Right? And the flea walks around, you know, eventually, you know, gets to an end, whoop, and then goes down, whoops, down, and eventually trunk, oh, it's an elephant! Right? So that travel of the flea over the surface of the elephant until it gets the gestalt of it's an elephant, is an idea that knowledge requires the putting together of parts into a whole, and it's the whole that gives significance to the parts. And that's what, rough and readily, you may say, the flea-elephant story is rough and readily what Kant had in mind by apprehension, reproduction, and recognition in a concept, threefold synthesis. Well, then, Cleve has three objections to this argument. And they actually seem to me interesting objections, although, as you'll see, my worry is, are they objections to Kant? So his objection is the following. Thinking about a passage at B154, where Kant says, about halfway on through the page, we cannot think a line without drawing it in thought, or a circle without describing it. We cannot represent the three dimensions of space save by setting three lines at right angles to one another from the same point. Even time itself we cannot represent, save insofar as we attend in the drawing of a straight line, which has to serve as the outer figurative representation of time, merely to the act of synthesis of the manifold, whereby we successfully determine their sense, etc. That's true. Is the only way you can think of a line is by drawing it. The argument may be, I don't know about you, but sometimes I think of a line, I just think, a line. I don't kind of do this every time I think of a line. Sometimes I just imagine a line. So I don't seem to have to generate the line out of the activity of, indeed, typically the same with a circle. I can, of course, draw a circle, but I kind of think I have a circle in mind, the whole, before the parts. Here's another analogy. Think of a clock with a minute hand and a second hand. Now, it's perfectly true with the minute hand, kind of drive yourself crazy with this. You know, you're watching, and you're waiting for it to move, and you kind of blink. It's moved. You know it's moved, right? But you didn't see it move. So the effectivity of the movement is indeed just the way Kant describes it in the reproductive imagination. That is, the significance of it being at this point is that you remember that it was at this point a minute earlier. Okay, so that works this. But how about for the second hand? Second hand, those of you maybe never seen a real watch without digital things, but real watches, they used to go around, right? And the second hand would continuously move. Now, I take it again phenomenologically that's exactly what I see. That is, I see a continuous movement, and I'm not synthesizing the movement out of discrete parts. Here's a third. So, I mean, in both these cases, what's going on in both these cases? The claim is that Kant, for the minute hand, second hand, treats them as both the same, and yet for us, at least, they are phenomenologically different. And the reason, the argument might be, that he treats them the same is that he's treating parts as prior to the whole, and therefore beginning with an atomistic premise. So this is the worry about whether Kant has a kind of Humean empiricist premise of a kind of atomism. And what's kind of wrong with that is that if we have a manifold in front of us and we have to synthesize it, then at the end of the synthesis we'll have a unified manifold, which again will be complex, and if it's complex, then we'll have to synthesize it, and we get an infinite regress. So it can't be the case that every complexity, every manifoldness, requires an external synthesis for its awareness, or you just get an infinite regress of the acts of unification. Well, Van Cleve deduces from this that there's no such thing as synthesis. I deduce from this he's misreading Kant. Why? What makes us think he's misreading Kant?
Can you back up to this infinite regress? I'm missing one.
Sure. It's simply the presumption that if we cannot apprehend the parts of a manifold straight off in one act, then we are going to generate a regress, since any synthesis will culminate in another complex manifold. That is, acts of unity don't make manifoldness disappear. They order it, right? And if the ordering of it is not itself something that supervenes on the manifoldness completely, then you're just going to have the problem of complexity all over again. why. I mean, think of what it's like to learn a language where someone gives you a simplified version of a complex statement in that foreign language, and you're just as confused. And you're just as confused because you're waiting for the final hook, something that will give something to you immediately, that will hold it together, and that's what seems not to arrive by this method. And the argument is, of course, I've been kind of urging all along, it can't arrive because the unity that we want is nothing that is gotten from the mere addition of parts. If it was the mere addition of parts, we wouldn't need spontaneity. The reason that there's a moment of spontaneity is because the whole that we're going to achieve, back we go, the square is green, is given by a notion of unity that is nowhere to be found in the object. But if it's nowhere to be found in the object, then it follows that the whole is prior to the parts. And I said this is the principle of idealism. If I have a principle of idealism, it's the whole is prior to the parts, whereby in empiricism the parts are prior to the whole. It's one way of going at it. So that it must be the case that whatever things are thought, and this, by the way, is James's principles of psychology again. It's just my Jamesian day, I guess. Whatever things are thought in relation are thought, James says, from the outset. From the outset in a unity. And of course, this fact is one of the great puzzles of Kant's system. Namely that, in some sense, the unity must proceed, be prior to the parts, even if the comprehension of the object through that act of unification can only be conceived as an act of synthesis. Why must it be an act of synthesis? Because the kind of unity that the object bears is not one found in the object. It's in our treatment of the object. So we both require a certain holism, right, and now the way in which I tried to introduce that yesterday, let's call it a week ago, it feels like yesterday, I get so excited. In Longuenesse, the way I tried to bridge the gap between the primacy of whole over the parts and the necessity of synthesis was through her notion of conatus. That is a teleological movement in which the gathering up was dictated by an end in view, that is presupposed as, let's call it, the reflective substratum of any accomplished judgment. So in other words, let me put it in a more colloquial vein, once you learn how to judge, then you learn how to make the steps toward judgment. That is, once you know how to speak the language, you can then use parts of language in order to do things. But you can't do. The point here is the parts only make sense after you've got the principle of the whole, not before. Now that said, because this is therefore doing the synthesis, then the I think is both the doer of the judgment and the principle of unity in the judgment. So my suggestion was last week that the I think must accompany all my representations. By that thought, Kant did not mean that for every judgment I make, I must be able to ascribe that judgment to myself. What's wrong with that, Paul? What's wrong with the thought that the idea of necessity of self-ascription? That for every judgment I make, I must be able to ascribe that judgment to myself, as the I think. Exactly. What's wrong with these self-ascription thoughts is that they want the self or the awareness of self as something over and above the judgment. That is, as an awareness of self that's isolable from the judgment made. And what I was trying to insist upon, and this will help us when we get to the paralogisms in 34 seconds, is the non-isolatableness of the self from the judgment made. So that all the stories about identity and self-ascription fall afoul because they want the notion of self-consciousness or self-awareness or the role of my Cartesian awareness, all of which, they want all of that to be something that is above and beyond and independent from the judgment itself. On the account I've been offering, all representations composed in intuition are mine, or must be apperceivable by me, means, and means only, they hang together in an appropriate unity. So on the account I'm giving unity, does the work that Cartesian consciousness does in other accounts. That unity is the bearer of the I thing. Being aware of something as red and green and round and, you know, is already to be appropriately self-aware. And to say the I think must be able to accompany, that is the possibility, simply points out what that a further representation of must be connectable. Right? So it's not that I have to add my thinking to it, it's that I have to bring it into a series of representations that I've already got. Okay. I will come back to all of that at the end of the session when I finish off the introduction. But let me turn to the paralogisms, since I promised we were going to have some fun. And I can see this is not fun. The paralogisms are part of Kant's transcendental dialectic. The topic of the transcendental dialectic in general is the problem of dialectical illusions, and dialectical illusions, Kant thinks, are those illusions which reason irresistibly and of its own intrinsic movement generates. So that if you are a rational being, you cannot avoid hitting upon these illusions. Not to have these illusions shows you how you're not thinking seriously. So these illusions are... So that Kant has a doctrine whereby the excesses of thought, let's call the excesses of thought metaphysics. The excesses of thought that we call the tradition of metaphysics are the inevitable movement of the way in which reason extends beyond its own proper domain of usage into an area where it does not belong, but out of its own principles. Its own principles push it in this direction, and therefore it simply doesn't stumble upon them by wild mistake. At B397, and the writing in the dialectic, or I think the writing in the dialectic, is unlike Hawthorne elsewhere, I find utterly charming. So it's where the Critique of Pure Reason suddenly becomes readable. Of course, you will have to read 300 pages to get to anything readable. And many have to spare before then. But once you get there, it's great fun. So he says at B397 that there will be syllogisms which contain no empirical premises, and by means of which we conclude from something which we know to something else of which we have no concept, and to which, owing to an inevitable illusion, we yet ascribe objective reality. An inevitable illusion, we ascribe objective reality. For example, the world as a whole, the existence of God, the immortality of the soul, any of the ideas that philosophers have been most wedded to. These are all simply inevitable illusions. These conclusions are then rather to be called pseudo-rational, rather than rational, although in view of their origin, and those he now rejects, let's not call them pseudo-rational, he says, they may well claim to the latter title, to be rational, since they are not fictitious and have not arisen fortuitously, but have sprung from the very nature of reason. So Kant has a doctrine of reason's intrinsic proneness to metaphysical nonsense. Or metaphysical nonsense is itself rational. Not, of course, valid, not objective, not even true, but it is rational, so that reason takes us places where we ought not to go, and that, as far as I'm aware, although we mentioned in the survey, Kant is the first person I know who's actually thought of this as saying, look, it's not as if my predecessors were stupid, or they all made mistakes, or they all said things they should not have said. On the contrary, he's trying to explain and, in a sense, vindicate why philosophers have, up to him, been wrong. He's trying to make intelligible that philosophers have thought differently than he, and trying to say that the intelligibility is not a kind of arbitrary intelligibility or contingent one, it's part of the very structure of reason. He goes on to say, therefore, that they are sophistications not of men, but of pure reason. Even the wisest man cannot free himself from them. After a long effort, he perhaps succeeds in guarding himself against actual error, but he will never be able to free himself from the illusion which unceasingly mocks and torments him. So the thought is, even when I know better, there's something in the very movement of my thought that, for example, leads me to think of the self as substance, or as simple, or as so strictly identical with itself over time, it must be capable of immortality. Those are the three paralogies. That we're all tempted, therefore, by those, and that, in part, what he has to do, therefore, is both show the necessity of the belief and its fallaciousness.
Right? So it's a double burden he's putting on himself.
Well, of these dialectical illusions, the ones that concern the self, he calls paralogisms. So Kant has a name for different kinds, every domain in which we can make false metaphysical judgments has its own kind of name. Paralogisms, antinomies.
What else? There's one more.
There's another P one.
So he said at the beginning of the next paragraph, there are then only three kinds of dialectical syllogisms, just so many as there are ideas in which their conclusions result. In the first kind of syllogism, I conclude from the transcendental concept of the subject. So now, something important is happening already. The source of all these illusions, all the mistaken views about the subject, is the transcendental concept of the subject. So the very idea of the transcendental unity of apperception, as Kant discovers it, leads to false doctrines of subjectivity. False doctrines about the nature of the self. So, it contains, I conclude from the transcendental concept of the subject, he says, which contains nothing manifold, the absolute unity of the subject itself, of which, however, even in so doing, I possess no concept whatsoever. The dialectical inference I shall title transcendental paralogisms. So, from the very idea of the transcendental unity of apperception, the I think, I'm going to generate a series of false ideas about what it means for me to be me. What it means to say, to use the word I. So Kant has to think that something about, let's say, the very use of the word I is going to mislead us in certain systematic ways, because the use of the word I, as it is bound up in the idea of a transcendental unit of perception, namely the I think must be able to accompany all my representations, is generative of a series of misleading ideas. Well, Kant's central thought is this, throughout the paralogisms. Neither the transcendental unity of apperception, nor what we might call apperceptive self-awareness. I'll come back to what is apperceptive. Let's say our awareness of ourselves as thinking. Apperceptive self-awareness. Neither of these phenomena tell us anything about the mind or the self's true structure. If I can use a slogan, since I've said all along that transcendental apperception is a function of unity, then let's say that function does not determine substance. That's why I keep reminding you of Searle's book, Substance and Function. He just saw that as what a good Kantian would do, translating substance talk and function talk. So the thought is that the spontaneities of the subject, and I'm not denying the spontaneity, leave its substance unknown. So that there is underneath all this a kind of agnosticism. The I think does not carry us into a knowledge of what the self is. Now, the reason that the illusions arise is because apperceptive self-awareness seems to imply that the self is a substance, that it is simple, and that it persists.
And those are the three thoughts.
That's your paralysis. It's a substance. That because when I'm self-aware, I'm not aware of any complexity, and must be simple. That whenever I'm aware now of a memory of something I had in the past, I'm aware of myself as the same thinker, and I necessarily believe that myself persists the same, the very same, through time. Persistence equals strict identity. Strict identity, as I'll show you, will give you immortality. Wouldn't it be nice? So these are the illusions that can't be avoided. And the reason why they emerge is again because of what the unity of apperception does. Let's remind us of what it does to get here. Namely, a multiplicity of representations can be synthesized into the object of a single representation only if they have a single common subject. Think of my 12 men and women, as it were. Why they failed, right? We need a single common subject that is the source of the unity of the whole. So we can Kant's first thought here, even before he gets there, is that we can represent a subject of representation only from a subjective point of view. This is a deep thought. It's at A347. He's trying to generate the thought behind the paralogism. And he says, now I cannot have any representation whatsoever of a thinking being through outer experience, but only through self-consciousness. Objects of this kind are therefore nothing more than the transference of this consciousness of mine to other things, which in this way alone can be represented as thinking beings. Is that true?
What's he arguing, and is it true?
What's the point?
No access to other thinking beings except through my own experience of myself.
And what's the conclusion from that? What was he driving you to think? In other words, what does follow from your knowledge of me, say, or in my thinking, or your appreciating of my thinking, from that claim? Yeah?
I guess there wouldn't be any recognition of otherness as otherness.
He certainly thinks that. He certainly thinks that the notion of otherness is a way of disqualifying another, not counting them in. So yeah, he thinks the notion of otherness is a mistake. That's right.
How is that different from Cartesian solipsism?
I would say it's almost the opposite. Why? Eric's asked the right question. This is Eric, everyone.
He's busy.
Why isn't it Cartesian solipsism? What is he saying here?
I think if you're judging representations of outer objects, something like that.
He's not saying that, because he is saying that we cannot have any representations of a thinking being through an outer experience, but only through self-consciousness. Objects of this kind are therefore nothing more than the transference of this consciousness of mine to other things, which in this way alone can be represented as thinking beings.
So the analogy of the line, like drawing the line, that solipsism would be you have the idea of the line in your head. The Jungian extreme is you have to draw the line. Right, just saying you're aware of the drawing itself?
Certainly that, but now we need another person. We still need a second consciousness here. How do I get a hold of another person's consciousness? Yep.
I guess if you're aware of another person's consciousness, you're aware of the fact that representations are theirs, that when they have the I think is belongs to their representation. So you can't have an intuition of that, and because then you'd have to posit yourself in the other subject eternally. So you have a representation of yourself as thinking insofar as you can be self-conscious and have an I think and intuit it some way internally.
Okay. You can actually go two ways on this. So Gabe rightly says, what it is to conceive of another as another person is to conceive of another as another point of view on the world. All right? Now, that can mean one of two things. You can either do that thought in a Sartrean vein, and in a Sartrean vein, when Sartre has that great scene, right, of walking through the park, he has, you know, the park is just all his, right? And he just has this idea of the park, and it all appears... There's Sartre. Here's some glasses.
He's bigger.
He's bigger. He's bigger. An unhappy Sartre. And there's the whole park seen from his point of view, right? And it's as if the park is his orientation on the world. And then what happens is that Simone enters the park, right? And her consciousness cuts through his orientation. So to be aware of it is to be aware of another point of view on the world. That's one version of it, of seeing that the other is an I think. So it's not solipsistic. Gerg, he says, my experience is of the park draining away, as if it's no longer mine. Right? And of course, no longer mine means it becomes objective. But then there's something else. I can read a novel, say Force of Circumstance, and then I can inhabit her point of view on the world. Now, the point here is, a lot of you weren't out at Bill Bromley's talk, and I'm sorry, you need to come to the workshops. There's a good one by one of our own graduate students on Thursday. We have a kind of loyalty principle. When our own give talks, everyone shows up. So those are speaking, those are some common. One of the things that Bill Bromley said is, what is irreducible is the first person and third person points of view. And the way of thinking about that, just to give an example, is the difference between intending something, say I intend to pick up the piece of chalk and throw it up in the air, and predicting what's going to happen. So I treat the other as an object, not as a thinking being. When I treat them as a thing from an external point of view, by, say, treating them as nothing but a consequence of their empirical psychology, their history, their everything up, and I predict what they're going to do. So I know Scott hearing this, he's going to be worried and anxious, and I predict he'll come into my office and say, you know, I understood what you were saying, but really, here's the opposite, right? And I can predict this, right? Maybe. But the thought is, that's treating the self at the level of the empirical self. At an empirical level, and not really as a self at all, but as a thing. Kant's suggestion is, if the I think is the orientation, thinking attaches to the notion of the I think, and the I think is the point of view of spontaneity, then the only true access to another is to take up their point of view. To try to understand them, as we say, from the inside and not the outside. So it's not solipsism. It's the problem that others, we can only deal with others, if you're Husserlian, as kind of alter egos, as other I thinks like us. And therefore, you're right, the otherness of the other drops away. Which probably is a good thing. Yeah.
So this, the transference of the consciousness of mind to other things,
right,
more a principle of sympathy than appropriation?
It's a, well, pr-
principle of identification, yeah. Sympathy would be a morality that would go along with that, but yeah.
That's the idea.
That, this is to say the notion of thinking and the first-person perspective is irreducible for Kant. It's irreducible. So to treat another as a person is to treat them as a first person, not as a privileged member of a group of objects, some of whom you treat better than others. Say the ones that are featherless bipeds better than the ones with feathers. And better them than the ones with, you know, 4 feet and so on. So for Kant, then the second thought that goes along here is the following. The I think is an experience, but not experience sensitive. What does that mean? Not, I think is an experience, but not experience sensitive, that is, not a source of empirical knowledge. Come on. Joe, what's that about?
I'll let you explain. Yes. I could have answered the previous question. Let's go back to Descartes and I'll go on, but I'm not even going to venture.
What does it mean to say that the I think is an experience, but not experience sensitive?
A gerund, not a noun.
Yeah, that will do. Want to help everyone out with that thought?
It's an ing. You know, it's a doing, an act. Not
okay.
Some, so can you just, again, a what?
Exactly right. What you're going to get from the I think, you have when you think, you're judging, you have an awareness, all right, you have the experience of the judging, but this judging is no different, the awareness of it as judging is no different from any other judging except for the content of the judgment. That's what differs from judgment to judgment. So although I have an experience of myself as judging, the differentiations between my different judgings are their contents, not the judging itself. So the judging is an experience, but not an experience of something that is empirically differentiatable from other judgings. So in other words, say it another way, I learn nothing about myself from the experience of judging. On the contrary, I learn about the world, which is a good thing. If I kept learning about myself when I judge, I would always get in the way of the world and not learn anything about it. So the claim that the I think must accompany all my representations, for to think of that as somehow having enough richness to be a experience, it's going to be an experience that is not going to have the weight of something that can be empirically complex or differentiable. It is, yeah.
Does that second point negate the first in a sense, or at least negate the way you're thinking it in an existentialist direction? Because if there's a power that I think is just this capacity for doing it, transcendence of the empirical, then it doesn't seem to fit into spontaneity as unique individuality representing a whole worldview. It seems to be separating itself from the worldview.
It's not a worldview, it's a view on the world. Now, this is terribly important. When I say that I see, it's not that the notion of point of view is that you must see the world from somewhere. Not that you see the world from your worldview, which is a thick, complicated, empirical stuff. No, no, no. All I mean here by the Sartre Beauvoir is that you can only judge by judging from a point of view on the world. That's what it is to judge. That's why the I thing must accompany it. So to be a judger is to have a point of view on the world, and that's what's ineliminable. You should all rush out and get some coffee. A strong or vodka, whatever will